Welcome to another episode of the English version of Book Lover's Companion. For this episode, I had the pleasure to talk to Cynthia Huygens, author, publisher, and member of the Brussels Writer Circle. Welcome to Book Lover's Companion.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm always delighted to talk to people, especially authors. Carmen forwarded your address because she's also a member of the Brussels Writer Circle. What can you tell our audience about the Brussels Writer Circle? What does the group do? Who can join? And when and where do you meet?
So the Brussels Writer Circle, I discovered when I first moved to Brussels because I was looking for other writers. And I had just arrived from Egypt and I was feeling fairly isolated. I didn't know anyone here. So I just Googled Brussels Writers and I came up with the Circle. And the Brussels Writer Circle is a very informal group that meets weekly and has been meeting at the same restaurant for a dozen years now. The group has been in existence for, I think, 25 years. And there's no leader. It's a very loose kind of organization, but we do have an annual general meeting and we do organize retreats and we have put out 3 anthologies. So we do get things done as a loose kind of informal group. And it's really designed to support writers at whatever stage they're at in their development. So we have all EU countries represented and countries beyond. And the sort of common thread for everyone is that they are writing in English. So we get together, we talk in English and we read our work written in English and we critique each other and support each other in developing our craft. And it's open to every writer. There's no restriction on genre or age or publications. We have some writers who are extremely well known in their own countries and well published, and others who are just starting out on their journey. So it's a real mix.
So I can join when I come to Brussels?
Absolutely. We love visitors and we do frequently have visitors that just find out about us and show up at our meetings, and that's always a lot of fun.
And I gathered that Carmen set up her own circle in Brazil.
Yes, she did. She took the format and started it there. And she's, I think, really benefited from the group that she's been able to establish there. And they had, she was included in our most recent anthology, by the way. She had a short story in anthology. And she coordinated a launch in Brazil, which was really fun. And the book has made it into some hands there. So we're really happy about that.
I also have it.
Ah, good.
I haven't started yet. I meant to. I have to say, I'm sorry that I haven't started yet. Other things got in the way, I'm afraid.
The good thing about this anthology is it's a collection of short stories and poetry. So you can just pick it up and read, pick up in any page and start off, and you're not locked into a novel length read. So
that's true. I've read at the beginning of the book that it was published by Idle Time Press. It's your publishing house, isn't it?
Yes. So I started Idle Time Press in June of 2019, and my intention was not to publish the anthology, but it happened that I was able to do it. My focus is really on children and upper middle grade as they're launching into young adult. And I started the business, and I have 3 books coming out this year in 2020, which are really the debut collection for Idle Time Press. But we did the Circle 19 of Brussels anthology in November of last year. Mm-hmm. So officially that's our first publication.
And the other books will be your books or from other authors?
So I have 2 are mine. One is an illustrated children's book. So I'm working with a collaborator, illustrator in Los Angeles, Ann Costa, and that book will launch in July, and that book is called Polar Bear and the UFO, and it's a really fun rhyming story and then some fantastic illustrations, so I'm really excited about that. The second is a novel for 12 to 14 year olds that takes place in Egypt, and that is mine, and that novel I wrote a couple of years ago, and I was debating on whether or not I wanted to query agents with that novel and go the traditional publishing route, and I just decided after a lot of exploration that I was going to do it myself. That was really more in keeping with what I wanted to at the end of it.
I read on your homepage that you are at home in the arts and that you spent 5 years in Egypt.
Yes, almost 6 years.
Yeah, and I get it. That's where you started writing. Like you said, you started the other novel in Egypt.
No, I did start the novel in Egypt and I finished it there. But actually, I have been writing for a really long time, and I pulled this out from I pulled out my first sort of official publication from 1994, and it's not something you can find on the internet, but at the time I was working in California, and I was asked to write something, it's called 101 Ways You Can Make a Difference 365 Days a Year. And it was targeted at teenagers and ways that they could get involved in their community.
Okay.
And so I have been writing as part of my job for many, many years. I decided about 10 years ago to venture into fiction, and that's when I started writing the novel that is coming out this year. So my background is in art education. I have a master's in art education, and I worked for many years in museum education, and I wrote a lot of the materials that visitors would receive when they came to the museum. I like that kind of very descriptive way of writing, mm-hmm. and trying to create in words a sensory experience. So a lot of my writing is like that.
On our German podcast, my co-host and I talked about museums, especially those in London. We both enjoy them a lot, and they do things better than they do it here in Austria.
I think, you know, museums, I have a real soft spot for museums wherever they are, and whatever type of museum they are, because I think that they are so important to preserve the history and culture and art of peoples. And it's, you know, a lot, some of these things are being lost, languages are being lost. And I think that they're really, really important. So I support them wherever they are.
Good to know. They have a lot to catch up on in Austria, I'm afraid. Especially the experience of visiting a museum. They have to catch up on the way how to present things. They're getting there, but it takes time. So you said you write young adult novels. Do you have any role models for this kind of genre? Because I always think of The Famous Five by Enid Blyton.
So Neil Gaiman novels, the Philip Pullman novels, which are for this age group and beyond. I really love Stephen King, as bizarre as he is. And I think that writing for that age group comes partly from a bit of nostalgia about being that age and how fun and exciting everything is, but also carrying the weight of stepping from childhood to adulthood. And the burden in some cases that is for kids, and how that plays out in their behavior and the way that they interact with their environment and people in the world. So I like exploring that.
So more or less the coming of age stories.
Yeah, I think so. And when I was, I'm a parent of two grown men now. And when my youngest was this age, he was such a fanatical reader. And he came to a certain point where he wasn't ready for adult subject matter, but the other things were a little bit beneath him. And so what I'm trying to create is the type of book that he would have enjoyed reading at that age that's exciting enough, but it doesn't really deal too much with adult content. It's subtle. It's not the primary premise. But more about just being a kid and interacting with the world and how they take things on.
And would you say nowadays, is it harder to get children or young adults to read? Because there are so many distractions, like the internet or mobile phones and all kinds of apps.
I don't know if it's harder. I think, and kids certainly have a lot of competition for their time. A lot of the kids I know are busy with sports, busy with their social groups. Social media is just kind of supports all of these things that they do, but it's not sort of the end game. And so I think providing content that they can read on the go on their devices, of course, is one way to you know, appeal to that age group. But I think also encouraging them to read in the traditional sense is really important, because so much of our history and culture is captured in words. And if we can't take the time to read them, that's going to be lost forever.
Do you think the Kindle helps? Because there was a survey a few months ago where it said that younger people in their 20s prefer hard copies or paperbacks to Kindle.
I don't know what the research says about this age group particularly, but from my own experience, I didn't turn to the Kindle until I moved to Egypt, where English printed books were not available to me. So I think it can be really important for people who don't have access to hard copy books, and that could be for socioeconomic reasons. It can be for geographical reasons. And so I think there is a place for Kindle. For my children's illustrated book, I'm actually doing or exploring how to present it in a digital audio format that's not necessarily animated, but has some animated elements to it. And so that, you know, because a lot of these young children have their own tablets and the kid, their parents are loading them with content. And so I would like to explore that more fully. And I'm also looking at doing digital advanced reader copies as opposed to the traditional hard copy.
One of my students recently said to me when I told them why don't you read a book when there is a break, when you have finished your tasks? And he said, it's the 21st century. Yeah, so what?
Yeah, so where are kids getting their knowledge? You know, unfortunately, we're not sure.
This question is about your writing process. How would you describe your writing process? Because I've talked about it with Carmen and my other guest. And the question is, are you the meticulous planner, for example, or do you go with the flow?
Yeah, I think we call that a pantser. I started out really as a pantser and just started writing, and really enjoying the process of writing without a lot of restrictions. But what I had at the end of the day were boxes and boxes of words that didn't always string together in any coherent kind of way. So I've learned to be a plotter, and I work now from outlines. But I also allow for a lot of serendipity and maybe a little bit of the unusual to enter into my work. For example, I love tarot. And so I might, if I'm feeling a bit stuck on something, I might turn to tarot cards for some inspiration. I very much interact with nature and try to, when I'm out in nature, to make sure that I'm bringing back some ideas for my work. And so I do work from outlines. I do write alone, not in a coffee shop like some people do. I like to be in my space, and I write a lot by hand. I capture a lot of notes by hand, which sometimes gets a little messy, but it's a little old-fashioned, but I like it.
And do you limit yourself to certain genre when you write adult novels, or would you say you cross genres?
So I don't limit. For instance, I have a short story in the second Brussels Writers Circle anthology, which is for adults, but it's not, that's not really where the joy is for me. I also produced a book of nonfiction a couple of years ago called My Grandmother's Memoir, which is part stories, part cookbook. And that is all ages, really, not really adult, but, you know, it's more of a sort of a family book. But my interest is really in the younger, upper middle grade, I would say, genre fiction. For sure.
Can you detect any differences between a European and a United States audience?
Do you know, I have found since I've been in Brussels, which is about 3.5 years, that the interest of Europeans in English literature seems very high. I think it's harder in some ways to get into the American market or North American market. Canada may be a little bit different. I have a little more experience with Canada, but there's so much competition and people not as interested in hearing something different. And I think for Europeans, at least here in Brussels that I've encountered, there seems to be an openness to English language literature and contemporary pieces. There's quite a lot happening with poetry here in the city, which is kind of a new thing for me to be interested in, but it's very active and it includes all ages. And I think that's what makes it so attractive, is there's no closed door. As you might have in some other places.
So in essence, you would say Europeans are more open to other or new experiences compared to audiences in the United States.
I think so. I do. And I think part of it is that, you know, geographically speaking, Europe is not really much larger than if you took North America, for instance, and travel across. But you have in America, you have, I think, less of an openness to outside ideas, less of an openness to different ways of looking at problems or lifestyles or whatever. You know, there just seems to be this sort of unspoken kind of prevalent sort of way of thinking. But you can see it when you're visiting, and you can see it when you interact with people and when you go places with your work and you share it and how people respond to you.
Might be the case. It's only my opinion, because we in Europe are more aware of the fact that if you get on a plane for, say, 2 hours, you are in a completely different country with a different language and different culture. It's different in the United States. You get on a plane for, let's say, 5 hours, and you are still in the United States.
And you might even still be in the western half.
I mean, yes, like, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yes. And I think that's, and even though you could say that each state within the Union of the United States of America has its own distinct characteristic and sort of way of being, and sometimes the dialect is slightly different, it's still really core American. And here, of course, it's different. Even though it's EU now, the countries really do maintain a distinct distinct nature. And Belgian is a really good example. There's a real, there's a language divide, French and Dutch, and then there's a tiny pocket of German.
Flemish. What
is yes, it? Yes, it's Flemish, yeah, which is essentially a Dutch dialect. And so you have people across the street speaking different languages who sometimes refuse to speak the other language. Mm-hmm. And so English seems to be kind of the neutralizing language. Yep. It's the common language. So
exactly. Makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, for me especially.
Absolutely.
I've enjoyed this.
Yeah. It's the same with you, and the British speak the same language, but you're also divided by the same language. The same could be said about Austria and Germany, for example.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And what about authors? When you compare European authors and authors from the United States, could you also detect a difference in the way they describe things or how they write?
I don't know if I can really speak to those differences so much. You know, like if I were just going to pick something off my desk, which I have several books on my desk at the moment. But for instance, I have Alan Bennett, The Uncommon Reader.
Yeah. A wonderful book.
I love his sense of humor, and I love how he speaks to human nature and really just the stories that he tells. I wouldn't say he's necessarily a common British writer, but he definitely represents and it would be among the best, I think, of contemporary British writers. So I don't know how to answer that question. I think I don't know that I have read many novels by European authors that weren't a translation. I've read any really other than in the English language, and sometimes those are not written as English but are translated. And I think through that process, something happens that in a way dilutes what the original intent of the words were. And so even in that respect, I think it's hard because I don't have the luxury of reading it in its native language. I'm missing something already. Mm. And it's reflected in the view of the translator, wherever they come from and whatever they're bringing to that process. So I don't know if I can answer that very intellectually.
I think your answer was quite interesting because I think translation is an art form. It's very difficult, for example, to translate a joke, to translate humor, because there is a lot of cultural background, especially in a joke, to get it. A teacher once said to me, if you dream in a different language, you speak the language. And if you get a joke, then you're quite fluent in this language.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do. And I think, you know, I miss out a little bit. Well, I miss out a lot, actually, because I don't have access to the breadth of talent here that represented in all these various languages, because I'm only getting what's come through the translated avenue. So I do miss out a lot on that. And last night I went to a poetry reading and it was in Slovenian. I understood nothing. And then the translated version was in Dutch. And it was really interesting I sat through the whole thing and I got actually quite a lot out of it, but I didn't really understand what was being said. So for me, the beauty came in how the words were delivered and the inflection of the voice of the reader and the reactions of the people who understood the language and that sort of thing. So it was a different way of enjoying it.
But don't worry, not all Europeans speak all European languages. Usually we speak one or two others than English, let's say French or Spanish or Italian. That's it. But I can only speak for Austria here.
I think if we were given more time, we could make that more of a priority. But of course, you know.
I also find it always interesting when I read about the United States and what you said about books and openness. It strikes me as strange or interesting that the United States always tends to reshoot movies.
Yes, it's it is interesting. You know, right now, I think part of it is driven by commerce. So, for instance, in the United States, and this is happening in Canada as well, the real big market right now is the LBG market. And I have some really good friends who are experiencing great success with their books that deal with issues of transgender or, you know, whatever. And I think that if you look back over the course of the market in the U.S., of course, it is really about commercial success and pushing commercial interests at the expense of maybe real art. Mm. And that's, I think, part of the difference that you see in Europe, because you have writers from these different countries who wouldn't have that commercial market access anywhere. And so they're selling because people really love what they're reading and not necessarily what they're being told is a great thing to, you know, pick up at Barnes & Noble or whatever.
Would you also say that publishing houses tend to follow a certain kind of fashion? For example, in real fashion, if you have a certain kind of sweater or color, that's it. And you don't can buy anything else. Would you say?
Well, I think there's one eye on that. And then there's one eye looking at what's the next trend.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you want to make sure that you, because, you know, it takes a couple of years for a book to go through the whole publishing process. Yeah. So you really need to be ahead of the trend in a way, or be able to sort of predict it, or be able to influence it in such a way that is going to be a moneymaker for you. And so I think there's part of it is, you know, getting, you can't really get on the bandwagon. I'm not sure how that works in publishing, because there's just such a time factor with the production of a book. So it's, I think part of it is, if you're chasing that, great, fine, go for it. But I think for me, that's not really my interest. And it's more about putting out into the world books that I think people would like to read, and that represent what the story that I want to tell, as I want to tell it, not because it's going to be commercially viable or even, you know, a bestseller. But it's like making art, you know.
Yeah.
You make art because that's what you want to do.
Exactly. Absolutely true. Oh, yeah, I'm with you there.
Yeah.
So what about you as a reader? Do you have a favorite genre?
Do you know, I don't necessarily. And I think that's part of my personality. It's quite eclectic. I read a lot of craft books because I love to know how other people do things. And I also, like right now, I'm reading about death because it's very personal to me. So I think my sort of book selections vary from year to year and from stage to stage, life stage to life stage. I get a lot of pleasure out of life stories. You know, things that are told with a sense of humor, serious subjects that that I can relate to. And I love some element of fantasy, but not, I'm not a super, you know, like I'm not a science fiction lover. Sorry, science fiction lovers, but that's just never really appealed to me. And I'm not super into graphic novels, although, you know, the guys in my family really love graphic novels. I think, I don't know why, because I do really like visual arts, but for some reason that's just never resonated with me. I'm not a huge romance reader either. So everything else pretty much is okay.
So do you have a question for me?
So I would be interested in how you got going with your podcast.
How it started or in general?
Yeah, how it started?
It actually started with the German one.
Ah.
We are already 16 episodes in. My co-host and I met for coffee or for lunch, and I said to him, why don't we record our conversations? Because we talk about books, we talk about reading, we talk about writing. Let's record it and put it out there. Maybe people are interested. We talk about new books, books we enjoyed, and so it all started. And then I thought, why not also do an English version of Book Lover's Companion? And the first episode was the interview with C.A. Farlow. Then I got the Chattering Teacup to join me, because it's always easier to have someone else to talk to ask questions and so on. And I have to say, the German one has more listeners so far. And you can also follow us on Twitter or Instagram at book_companion. I usually put up a teaser before the next episode, usually on Wednesdays, and the following Monday the complete episode goes online at Anchor.
Oh, nice.
It went from there. Carmen agreed to do the interview.
How did you meet Carmen?
At Crimefest.
Ah, wow, cool.
Yeah. Well, like I said in our chat, we were neighbors, Austria and Slovenia. And we met in Bristol.
Oh, I love it.
Our common interest, crime novels.
Yeah.
And we stayed in touch.
Yeah, nice.
And
nice.
I keep my fingers crossed that she gets an agent this year.
I know. Yeah.
So she gets published. Good. It's harder when you do it on your own, self-publishing. I try to get people on my podcast to offer them a platform to promote their books, to promote their art.
That's really nice.
Yeah, why not?
I think it's
a good way to let people know what you have done, what you have created.
It's good. It's hard to reach, to always reach your reader, I think. The best way, of course, is word of mouth, because you take a recommendation from someone that you trust much more seriously than you would from anybody else. And so if you can get people talking about it and sharing, that's the best way for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Edith. It's been fun. Yeah, it was nice to meet you, and I wish you much success with your ongoing podcast. I think that's really fantastic.
I hope so.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a nice day.
Okay.
Thank you,
Edith. Okay.
Bye.
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 I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did making it, and we'll meet again at Book Lover's Companion.